Ways and Means Committee to order and open the public hearing on House Bill 5022, Department of Forestry. Susie, would you have anything to update us with today?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any updates. Just today we're going to do the overviews for protection from fire, forest practices, and forestry assistance if we can get there today.
Okay.
Over to
would you like to explain the new book we have? I guess it's
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a smaller, there's another book on your at your place, and what it contains is the backup documentation that for the budget and the PICS report that we didn't have yesterday. So you probably don't need to go to that unless you want a lot of numbers.
We'll have that all read by tomorrow, right?
Yeah. I have read that.
Good for you. Congratulations. Mr. Wu.
Good afternoon, Chair Meserly and member of the subcommittee. I want to refer to tab 3 on the Protection from Fire program and also want to note that all the other program sections are formatted similarly. And I will address the questions that we fielded yesterday from the fire program and forest practices, and I will cover the other questions as we go through the other programs.
And Roy, did you send this? Where does this go?
That's a replacement page. It goes under the I think it's under forestry assistance in section D. No, it is forest practices. It replaces the page 35 under that tab.
Okay.
His able staff provided that.
Good. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Ray.
Okay. I want to point your attention to page C2, the performance measures. The first graph portrays the number of fires or percentage of fires of 10 acres or less. And you see that anything above the dashed line is a good thing. And we've done well there. And we're projecting that for the last fire season, 02 fire season, however, we'll be a percentage point slightly below the line, roughly about 93% of our fires were 10 acres or less. And then on the number of man-caused wildland fires per 1,000 citizens, we're projecting for 02 fire season that we'll be actually above that line. I'm sorry, below it. Those last charts, the last two charts, actually, if you're below the line, the better. And we're currently calculating the fire size rating based on costs, acres burned, and fire season severity for O2, so we don't have that number for you. Chair Meserly, you asked about yesterday about our fire-related injuries and accidents yesterday. There's a handout there. Should be the very first handout. A couple of ways we looked at it last fire season. One is, as you look at compared to the 01 fire season, total number of injuries and accidents had 22 as opposed to 27, although our preventable accident was slightly more. But compared to our 10-year average of fire-related accidents and incidents, that number is 25. So clearly, last fire season, given the fact that that was our worst fire season in 50 years, we did pretty good.
And how does that compare with the feds? Do you have any documentation on that?
No, I don't. I can come back with those numbers if you wish.
That would be very interesting.
Okay. I will do that. And obviously, there's no fatalities here that indicate. I would like then to go to C7 and just quickly describe, if you will, the state's complete and coordinated fire system. C7 is actually a diagram of the program design. Basically, ORS 477 is our statute that gives us our marching orders, if you will. We work with, we have a board of forestry. And at that point, if you notice on the side, we get inputs from landowners, operators, interest groups, protection association. And I would probably suggest that input is probably understating our involvement with landowners and protection associations. They are actually our partners in this Oregon complete and coordinated fire system. On the other side of the chart, on the right-hand side, you see inputs from other state agencies, the federal agencies, and, if you will, there are cooperators. And you, and when you put all that together, it, it gives us our complete and coordinated fire protection system in Oregon. And as you go down the chart, you'll see that it, in terms of how we're structured and how we administer the protection program at the state foresters level, you'll see there's administration, coordination, prevention, operation, smoke, fuel and smoke management down on the bottom. Those, if you will, are sub-programs within the protection from fire program. Now, to further describe the complete and coordinated system, we refer to page C8, and there is a bigger map here in front of you to your left, which is a display of our protection districts. And those protection districts, the significant of them are that are composed of local landowner groups that are, if you will, our association, that help us with our budgets and our level of protection. And more importantly, they help us with, if you will, the complete and coordinated system in terms of providing resources on any given fire season.
Could you explain what it means, the counties in white?
Those counties in white are, if you will, the vegetation on those, that landscape is not defined in the statutes as forest type. So, in other words, they're either agricultural land, for example, in Morrow and Umatilla and Gilliam, basically they're wheat, and we don't provide protection for that under the statute. Harney and Mount Heer and Lake, Eastern Lake County, they're basically range, sagebrush, and they're predominantly being protected by the Bureau of Land Management and or the Division of State Lands through contract with the Bureau of Land Management provide protection for that area. Now, when we talk about unprotected lands, intermingled even within the dark area, but predominantly in those white areas next to, and if I may refer to the big map, in the center there where it says Central Oregon, and this is just an example. It says Central Oregon over here. And even part of this part of the state, I would describe as, I forget that I got these technical tools, that describe as unprotected, meaning that there's no agency that provides wildland protection like the Bureau of Land Management, or that there's no rural fire structure, organized rural fire structure department in those areas. So that's what basically we mean by unprotected land. So that's generally what the white areas represent for us.
Well, Roy, what does that mean if you get in those areas a fire going through the grass or whatever? Brush. Is there a point where you, because you can see it coming towards your protected areas, that you step out and try to hit it off or slow it down or something?
Chair Mersley and member of the subcommittee, yes. Our folks, using our professional judgment about the fire behavior for the day, for example, in the wind direction, wind velocity, and if you will, the risk that's ahead of that fire, if we make a determination it is a risk onto our protection, then we will engage and do what we can to put that fire out before it actually comes to our protection.
Is there any reimbursement at all then from the property owners? Or?
No. It's It depends on the situation. Last year we had a severe enough fire season in which every one of us protection agencies was, if you will, maximized in terms of our resources. So what happens at the state level is that the governor declares a conflagration act, and he basically authorizes structural fire engines to organize and actually go out in some of these areas, either help a existing fire department or work with the county in those unprotected lands to provide protection. And that kind of situation, there is actually reimbursement from the general fund to those fire departments. And there's also, the governor can direct the Department of Forestry also to deal with fires on unprotected land, and in those cases we come to the E-Board to be reimbursed for that action.
Is it a true statement to say that on the unprotected lands that the property owners themselves don't pay anything other than what they've contributed to the general fund?
Chair Meserly and member of the committee and Representative Morgan, they most accurately describe that they do not provide assessment or pay into wildland protection and or any structural organized fire department or organization. Okay. The structural people would say that for their definition, unprotected lands would be that there's no structural fire department that provides protection for those structures out there. For us, it can be the wildland or agency to provide protection in the wildland areas like the rangelands and grasslands.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Charlie Stone, Assistant State Forester for Protection. On the earlier question in terms of reimbursement, in some cases, if there's a responsible party, a negligent party in the origin or the spread of the fire, we have been able to recover some costs on unprotected lands. They don't pay anything into the overall protection up front, and lightning fires that start on a landowner's property, that type of thing, where there's no fault, there's no opportunity to recover. But, for instance, in the 2000 fire season, the Tamarack fire that we had over in Wheeler County, it started as a result of a burn barrel on unprotected lands, got away in the wind, and threatened and then burned on to protected land. I think we spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $3.2 million on fighting that fire, both trying to stop it before it got to the protected lands and then suppressing it on the protected lands. And we were able to recover somewhere in the neighborhood, I think, of $400,000 on that fire from the insurance that the landowner had, because we were able to demonstrate negligence in the fire.
Representative Krieger.
Chair Meserly, that conflagration order the governor gives, can you describe a little bit? I know, like in the Biscuit Fire, they took quite a few all the way from Bannon South, rural fire departments, had them on a line a certain length of time. I'd like to know how long they can be on the line without being paid. And I think it was kind of unique that a lot of the rural fire departments that have to struggle and hold barbecues for everything they get, and yet you've got all the private for pay, you've got the federal, you've got the state, and everybody's getting paid, and they had them there at Agnes for 23 hours, and they lost their time at their own places where they work. It seems to me like we need to address that. I wonder if you could kind of enlighten us how long you can have them without paying them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, in those situations where you're talking about the local rurals responding to other local rurals in the county, that's usually on the basis of mutual aid agreements between the organizations, and we have mutual aid agreements with the rurals and they with us. Typically, in those situations, they'll come to help for the first fire shift or for the first 24 hours, and that's on the reciprocal basis that it's, while they're not being paid for that any given fire, they're receiving in-kind response from other agencies when they have fire and need help. Beyond that period of mutual aid, then they've exhausted their resources. That's generally when they'll call for the Conflagration Act and say that they've exhausted the local resources and capabilities and ask for help from the state fire marshal and may or may not get reimbursed from the general fund following that. Does that get to the question?
I think it does, yes.
Well, I'd like to expand on that. So in the Biscuit Fire in Agnes, where it was the Forest Service, we had departments coming from all over Western Oregon, spending the fuel and everything to get down there. And very much the same situation as what Rick and Cricker talked about. But the Forest Service was sending them back in 23 hours so they wouldn't have to pay them. Has there been any clarification on that in regards to Forest Service fires?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. I'll try and find out.
Chair. I think it's interesting to note, I think the intent of that was for structural type fires, but they were actually called out to help with the actual forest fire itself, which is kind of unique. And then also that at the same time they're not paying them, they had rice farmers with five cats, and they took the cats off the truck. They found out nobody could take it off the side of the road because they were only used to plowing with them. So they spent over $100,000 on one rice farmer, and the guy didn't have a guy on site that could move that thing off a 10-degree slope. Waste.
Right.
That's not these people, but that's...
Right. That's for it. Hey, Roy.
Okay. Referring to page C9, this graph demonstrates the importance of effective initial attack on fires. And, of course, the shape of this graph will depend on the particular severity of the season. And what this graph intends to show is that when you look at the gray or shaded area, that the opportunity to catch fires and put them out is when they're small and when their fire intensity is at a lower level. And actually there's a time there in which you can actually take advantage of that initial attack, and then beyond that the fire behaves in an extreme manner that it just takes more resources, creates more loss to the resources. So really this just intends to show that there's an opportunity, in some cases a matter of minutes, and in other cases it may be longer based on the severity of the season. Last year I would suggest that this graph would in terms of where it starts sloping up into the extreme fire behavior, probably is more to the left. And in some cases when you don't have the kind of severe fire season, before that curve starts sloping up, it perhaps may be more to the right. But it just demonstrates here that the importance of initial attack and why that is important here. And then if you go to C10, you hear the term most efficient level. Bottom line is what that means is that for the pre-suppression dollars that you invest, in other words, your initial attack engines, your detection resources, lookouts, the more you invest in the pre-suppression effort, then the less you'll have in suppression costs, actually fighting the fire, and then in resource damage. So what you have is that as you move out on the bottom axis, you'll see that as you look at suppression costs and damage, it actually would be, and then you'll get a return in keeping the total cost plus loss down. But there's a point where the more you put in suppression budget, the return starts to diminish. So that's why you have a curve that's a U-shape. And the most efficient level, the significant of this concept, is that without appropriate suppression budget, you actually end up paying more in the fact that you have to fight the fire and you spend more money fighting the fire on top of the resource damage. So when you go back and look at C9, you have to look at those two charts together to understand how that works. So if you put the money up front in pre-suppression, you're more able to suppress the fire at the initial attack stage, which means that you save additional suppression costs and reduce resource damage. On page C11, it's just a display of the wildland-urban interface or the fire protection complex. And I'd like to follow up with a question that Representative Krieger had about what have we done in terms of working with the rural fire departments in this endeavor. In the past, we've had through federal grant money, we've invested with them $50,000 annually, and I understand that, and Charlie can expound on this, but just more recently, we have been able to help them invest $1 million in that effort to help the fire departments in providing adequate equipment and training.
Well, both through the National Fire Plan, they have funds, they call them RFA and VFA. RFA comes through the Department of Interior, VFA from the Department of Agriculture. But as Roy pointed out, under the National Fire Plan, the amount of money passed on to the states and to the federal agencies has jumped up considerably. And since the year 2000, each year, we've been able to pump about $1 million statewide into the rural fire departments in terms of training, equipment, both heavy equipment and personal protective equipment, that type of thing, to encourage them to organize in more fire departments. So across the board, have increased the ability for them to be a partner in the wildland situation as well as to do their own jobs at home. Also mentioned very quickly that in addition to that federal grant money, the federal excess personal property program that that we work with the Forest Service to acquire government surplus property is also made available to the rural fire departments to help them gear up.
And also on page C12 is a map of where these wildland urban interface areas are. The classic ones that we bump into every fire season is the one Jackson-Josephine County, Deschutes County, and to a lesser extent in Klamath County.
Roy, I was just going to ask you to respond. Some of those interface areas are along the coast and the fog belt. I would guess that the risk there is much, much less than when you get sure east of the Coast Range or even in the Cascades.
Chair Mearsley and member of the subcommittee, that's absolutely correct. And matter of fact, that's a good segue in the Senate Bill 360, and I'm going to ask Charlie to help me with some of this. But basically, when we look at, as a result of Senate Bill 360, there is actually a built into that bill, and it's actually the Oregon Forest Land Urban Interface Fire Protection Act of 1997. That bill recognizes the risks associated with different forest interfaces. And, in fact, our priority in implementing this bill is in the Medford Grants Pass area and also in the Bend Sisters area. And that's, in fact, where we're currently doing mapping and working on identifying just where our exactly where urban interface areas are in those locations.
Chair, I might add not so much to Senate Bill 360, but to the looking at the map in those areas on the coast. While generally speaking, the fire danger is more often less, the overall risk is less in those areas because of the density of homes in the forest cover. And the steep terrain, the homes at dead end roads and whatnot, if we ever had the fire conditions, and we certainly can, that would greatly complicate the firefighting in those areas and would become a very serious problem. So we do have to pay attention to the urban interface on the coast as well as the drier areas. Fortunately, we just don't have the fire occurrence in those areas.
Any questions at this point?
Comment? Okay.
At this point, I'd like to address a question that Senator Dukes had yesterday when we were describing the annual impacts of the fire protection program as we look in the 03-05 budget. And really, in terms, there should be a handout that you folks have that is entitled... Okay. But really, I've asked the staff to look at models based on last year's fire experience. What would be the significant difference between last year and as we think we're going to be looking at in terms of the 05-03 biennium? And I think it's important to note on the first page, there is a chart that talks about the resources that we currently have remaining in reduction. And I think if you flip to the second page, there's another chart. And I think the key point there that I want to make on this chart again is that when you look at the cost plus loss, the cost of fighting fires and the loss of the resources is approximately $22 million. And actually in two local cases, one in Grant County and one in Jackson-Josephine County, there's a significant difference in terms of acres, additional acres that would be burned, and additional loss to resources and damage. And that's actually described in page 3 and page 2. On page 2 is actually the one in what we call the Southwest Oregon District in Jackson-Josephine County. And really, the take-home there is we're looking at an additional suppression cost of anywhere from $1 to $5 million and a damage, additional damage to resources of $1.5 to $10 million. And you're looking at anywhere from 1,000 to 7,000 additional acres. And you look in John Day or Grant County, the numbers are very similar. Additional acres burn could be as high as 2,200 acres. And the damage could be in addition into roughly $1.7 million.
Sorry, could you give us some background on how you develop those figures? Is that based over a 10-year cycle average, or how do you do that?
What the folks did was they actually looked at last year and looked at what they had for dispatch for different... they actually went back and looked where they had fires, like lightning fires last year in John Day. And they basically said, for this fire, we deployed 5 engines and a crew. And we put it out at 10 acres. What they did then was, okay, based on what we think we're going to have for this coming fire season, if we were to have that same fire or experience that same fire again, say this time with 3 engines and maybe instead of 3 people, maybe 2 people on an engine and no crews, then they went back to their fire behavior model in terms of, based on the conditions for that fire last year, how big would that fire get? And then how much would it cost to suppress that bigger fire? And then what damage did it cause? Because that fire, if you will, grew in size.
So did that, we talked yesterday some about how to mobilize private crews and logging companies and those kind of things and equipment. Did that factor in if we could get some progress in how we approach these fires in the early stages?
Well, obviously, Chair Meserly and member of the subcommittee, what we're trying to do is make a bad situation and manage it the best we can, and working with the local associations that I refer to at each one of these districts, we have a combination of some districts working very closely with the landowners in terms of a cooperative venture, meaning that some of these landowners have actually employed the seasonal firefighters that we normally will have in June. They're planning on employing them in May and June, which we would normally have them. They would employ them in doing working for the company. Just in the fact that if we have a fire, then they become available. And other instances, we have districts like Douglas County, as I understand, and also Coos Forest Protective Association. They were able to get Title III money from the counties to do co-op work under those funds. And essentially what that does is make them available to us when we have fires for May and June. Right now, because how we had to deal with reductions of the in order to end the biennial balance, we are seasonal, are been reduced for 2 weeks, and that essentially means that they don't come on board for the most part until July 1st. So we're looking at those measures, working either with the county or local landowners to help them, have them employ our folks that we normally would have, so when we get fires, then they become available. The other thing we're doing is we're looking at our district employees, permanent staff, and basically their assignment when we have a fire, they become firefighters. If they're working on state forests or they're working on forest practices or forestry assistance, they are firefighters, number one, in this case. They will actually take an engine and respond to fires. I think the bottom line here is in terms of our capacity to address these fires at the initial attack stage, going back to that graph that shows the curve as you go from left to right, is that we are not efficient when we have to operate that way because, number one, the case of these people working either for landowners or for the county or their regular work, they may be somewhere doing their job that is not the most conducive. They're responding to a fire when that fire gets reported. We're just going to be limited by how many of these people we can actually have on other people's payroll or, and in fact, of our regular staff, you know, we're just limited there. So it's not the most efficient way to address the initial attack, keeping those every as much as possible, these fires being small. We're doing the best we can. The other thing I wanted to take an opportunity, and in the handouts, we're making a request.
Yes. Before we move on, then,
sure.
While they're passing that out, let me ask you. So when I look at the chart on page 2 of the last handout, the mitigation factors you just talked about, are they already included in this chart then? So even though we're doing some of those management things a little differently, still the numbers are going to be what we see. You're projecting the numbers are going to be what we see here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe it is. In looking at this a little bit earlier, I believe I recall in there that there's a delay in time built in there that, you know, we wouldn't be fighting it with just our crews. If it's going to get bigger, we're going to call in other folks. But the assumption is made that we're going to be brought in, bringing in contract crews or industry, and that the response time may be 4 to 12 hours after they're called for. And so when you're bringing them in from other places or from other jobs, it delays, and it's just like what I talked about. It points out the importance of that chart in terms of the time that the fire is building and getting away from us. And based on the assumption that we'd have to send for other resources, one more fire is going to be a large fire escape in the course of that unit over the course of the summer. That's obviously it's all modeling and it's a lot of assumptions, but it does build in the idea that those are delays in the system.
Okay.
I would like to further add in terms of what are we doing and given this situation. I alluded yesterday that we're in the process of making a request through the governor's office to the Bush administration and congressional staff for federal funds to help us with predominantly funding two large air tankers that we can contract, and also large helicopters and medium-sized helicopters because of the lack of the National Guard resources that's involved in the Middle East. What you have is a request to the Deputy Chief of Staff, who will talk to the governor and actually initiate a letter to the Bush administration. And so we'll see what we can get out of that. But this is an effort to help meet some of the shortage that we're going to have in the aviation resources. Also, yesterday, I alluded to a letter that we got from the Forest Service's Solicitor's Office. And that's a handout that should be coming out to you. And on the last page, on the last paragraph, the solicitor responds by saying that, in fact, that parties, meaning the state of Oregon in this case, may take independent action on federal fires that we believe will be a threat to us, and then, in fact, may have them reimburse us for that action. And as we speak, the two agencies are working on actually looking at our cooperative agreements in order to allow that to happen for the upcoming fire season. The other attachment or handout would be one that actually was signed from the regional forester and the state director of the Bureau of Land Management and myself, that directs all three agencies, but primarily the federal agencies, and the language is such that it says you must discuss the similarities and difference in protection direction provided by Oregon law and the local management plan on the federal agencies. I think in the back, when you flip to that back, it actually gets to not all, but certainly most of the issues that have really caused us conflicts in the past, such things as direct and versus indirect suppression strategies, use of dozers in suppression action, night suppression operation. And as I mentioned yesterday, that the federal agency will be expected to hold necessary home unit resources in place for local initial attack purposes.
So, Mr. Weir, you expect to have all of these in place for the start of season?
It is my expectation that the federal agencies, in working with us cooperatively, to have all these in place. Certainly, where the local line officers will be able to identify back to Salem and Portland office what the policy discrepancies are, and we'll be able to address them before we actually start engaging in fires.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I applaud this as a good first step, but the thing that's worrisome to me is that the direction here is to discuss differences, describe, consider,
this isn't a confidence builder in terms of solve, resolve, get answer. I think what we're saying to you, and I hear it from all members of the panel, is that we're less interested in the process and more interested in figuring out how helicopters and other assets don't sit on the ground when the world burns up. Do you have confidence that discuss is going to result in some solutions?
Chair Meserly and Representative Johnson and member of the subcommittee, yes.
Good.
And I say that based on, I think it's important, and I think it's actually on, and I'll let me get that. I think there's language in there that says all government land management personnel have the responsibility to be involved in suppression fire efforts. And then at the very last paragraph, fire size and intensity are growing because of increased hazard fuel and fire-dependent ecosystem. And then here's the sentence that I know we've talked about at the Borton level. The public expects us to work closely and cooperatively to deal with the growing wildland threats. And in fact, in those conversations, there are other documents that I didn't bring that actually talks about the specific items like the work rest ratio that I referred to yesterday, use of helicopters, and whose standards are they going to be working under on federal lands. We're going to be checking them off as we go through this, and they have that and they know it. And additionally, we have a standing meeting with Undersecretary Mark Ray and Jerry Williams of the Forest Service in Washington, D.C., basically to, if you will, to see how we're doing in this effort. And my hold card is, and the regional folks know this, is that we have to show results this fire season, or we're going to take the next level. And the next level is aware of that.
Well, that's comforting. I mean, I just keep going back to my own examples. We tried to give a helicopter one time that was carted in one forest to another forest, and they wouldn't take it because the gas cap locking mechanism was different. They were identical in every other way. Pilots have to be carted in different forests. Now, when I was carted and flying fires, it was a long time ago, but the Forest Service wouldn't accept the state wouldn't accept the Forest Service. It's that kind of stuff that I hope describe, reassess, consider, and discuss gets beyond.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I at some risk here, I'll counter the boss here a little bit in that I think that we're going to make progress on all of these items, and we've got, I'll report to you a couple of items quickly of significant progress in this area, and I think some of the others are going to be much harder to crack in terms of some of the policies that will remain the same for the Forest Service, where we're trying hard to get them to understand the flexibility that they have within their policies and to encourage them to use it, but specifically to the helicopters and the situation of different standards and whatnot, we have had a breakthrough, and I think this letter points at it and assurances within the region that the state will now be able to use its resources, fly the helicopters that we control onto the Forest Service, continuing the mission without having to meet their standards. They recognize that we can do that under our standards, that our standards are adequate, and they will still be able to reimburse us for those actions afterward. So that's a major breakthrough and change from last year. Another one has to do with the one helicopter manager per helicopter when flying under their standards, and they'll be telling their people that they have the ability to use two restricted type ships with one helicopter manager if they go through a certain procedure and waivers, and they'll be encouraging their line officers to do that in appropriate situations. So those are two very significant breakthroughs in the aviation resources. The work rest ratios, they haven't really changed the policy significantly, but they are encouraging their folks to understand what the policy really says. And as Bill Lafferty sitting behind us here, our fire program director, calls career fear, trying to deal with that type of situation that we saw so much last year, where the folks are doing everything strictly by the book because they're worried about the effect on their career if they happen to be involved in a situation that that goes sour on. And, the service does recognize these issues now. We've clearly gotten that and got through them. Now the test will be how much progress can they make in the time period of changing the behavior of line managers and fire managers to embrace these new ideas and move out of them. We think we'll see progress, and then we'll be able to evaluate the 2003 season and keep moving in that direction.
Thank you.
Senator Duke, did you have a question?
Yeah, a couple of them. The letter from the regional attorney of the U.S. Department of Ag, when they're asked about whether or not our state laws apply to them, says no. The United States or its agencies are not included in these definitions of owner and operator. Are we having any conversations about changing our definitions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I think the key here really is not so much our definitions or how our law is written, but it's the fact that Congress has actually given direction in laws that that provides for the federal agencies to use fire and not necessarily always have to suppress it when it when it starts. And therefore, I mean, if it was just policy of the Forest Service, I would think that we could make an argument that the state law would override that, but because there are apparently some congressional actions that trumps the state law is the way I understand this law.
Okay. And I guess I didn't take as much heart from that back sheet as you did. It says that, let's see, the parties may reimburse each other later. And I would read that to mean, or they may not.
Well, but the problem used to be that they interpreted that they could, if we didn't follow their standards. There are four elements that under National Transportation Safety Board regulations that determines who controls an aircraft, and it has to do with who procured it, who's paying for it, who's getting the benefit from it, and who's controlling it while it's flying. The Forest Service has been interpreting that because they ultimately reimburse us that they were paying for it, and therefore it had to fly under their standards. The key here is that the solicitor has said that it's under our control while it's flying, and they can still reimburse us later on without that being paying for the aircraft. And so it's hidden, and I would agree that if just reading this cold, it doesn't really tell you that much. But because of the Blue Ribbon panel on fire aviation that occurred this past winter around the country, and they're discussed basically in the report that the situation existed in terms of states not being able to fly onto federal land under their standards, there's considerable pressure to change that policy if they could. And with this interpretation, they're saying now that they do intend to. And we'll want to firm that up ultimately in our operating agreements and our master agreement so that there's no question down the road, but this signals a change in the willingness to do that.
So in essence, it gives you the ability to bill them.
Yes. To bill them and be reimbursed without them being in control of the aircraft and therefore having to apply their standards.
So what I've heard from agencies about getting federal reimbursement is not particularly positive in any arena. That is, if it shows up, it shows up a long time down the road. But I guess if it comes at all, that's a plus.
And to that end, this year we're getting much more rapid turnaround on the bills and settling up the accounts more quickly. That message has been heard as well, but there's some trade-off. We need to work within our systems to make sure that we can reciprocate. We are very specific about making sure that every record matches up and that you can verify the costs, and as we should be. Some of the solutions may be to form some agreements that generalize some of those costs and estimates. We could speed up the process more if we can do that in a way that we're comfortable that the costs are equalized. We work for them, they work for us, and it's more a matter of paying on the end who owes the balance of costs. So we're all concerned about cost containment. Some of the cost containment measures may be more efficient ways of billing each other back and forth, but that there's a lot of work being done on that right now.
Given the number of acres that they control, in this state, and given what you're telling me about their let it burn attitude, that's a pretty scary situation. And then if we continue reducing you, because now you've determined you can respond and they can actually reimburse you, but if I'm nervous if we take away their ability to respond.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, the national fire policy that each of the five federal land management firefighting agencies operate under, while it does allow them generally to allow fires to burn, they are in the process of clarifying that that can only be done when there is a specific plan in place that provides for the circumstances that determines when that happens. And I have to be a little careful here, but I think that they got a little sloppy in the last couple of years with the idea that operating under the general theory and not being sure that they were operating under the actual plan, because there are only a couple of small, relatively small areas in the state that have approved plans to allow fires to burn, one in the Eagle Cap Wilderness, I believe. And there had been one on the Calmeopsis where the biscuit fire took place, but that was rescinded a few years back. And in fact, they are expected to initial attack and extinguish fires rapidly on all of the rest of the resource lands that don't have that type of plan. And so that's something that we'll need to watch and work with them to make sure that they stick to those constraints.
Ray, how much funding do we have outstanding from coming from the federal government?
At this stage of the game, I believe that the Forest Service will end up reimbursing us about $10 million out of the overall $60 million, or nearly $60 million that we spent on extra suppression costs. And that, you know, that's for us doing work on their land, or the balance of the trade. And then in terms of federal reimbursement, the FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, will also be reimbursing us somewhere in the neighborhood of $17 to $18 million for those fires that were declared emergencies because of the threat to structures and communities. So altogether, about $28 million from federal reimbursement.
That we still have not been paid for?
We have been paid some of the FEMA money, and we are getting close with the Forest Service, but we're still settling some of those accounts.
And when do you kind of a time frame can we expect that to be paid?
I'll go out on a limb and ask you to. This is a little bit speculative, but I think, given the course that we're on in auditing our costs, dealing with the insurance company and our claims, that we should be settled up by fire season.
So, I'm going to pursue this a little bit. How do we cover ourselves in those kind of times? I mean, obviously we've had to pay our bills, I would think, most of them.
At an earlier point in the season, typically, am I going to get in trouble here? I don't know. What I understand to be the case is that within the funds, the various funds in the Forestry Department account, while we keep those accounted for, we sometimes borrow from fund to fund to pay the bills and then repay that money as we get our claims back in. In this year, because we had so much out, we actually had to borrow from the treasurer somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 million, or at least had a $30 million line of credit from the state treasurer, which we've been paying back with some of the FEMA reimbursements that we've already received.
So are we reimbursed the interest, the cost of that money?
I don't believe so. That ends up being a cost of the agency. Clark, can you help on that?
Yeah.
Yep, it's cost of the agency.
What does that amount to?
Chair Messerly, members of the committee, Clark Seeley, it'll be probably between $150,000 and $175,000. It depends on how quickly, as Charlie said, we get the federal payments this spring.
And I don't even have to look to my left. I know that Representative Johnson has questions.
You asked the lion's share of it, Mr. Chair. There's a real cost to us, and you asked it.
Mark, one for me.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ray.
I want to go back to the letter with the three signatures, and I forgot to mention also an important point about this document, and then I want to close about the document.
In the back, it says to consider local opportunity to use private, local, state, and federal resources. The word there that is that we have not seen is consider the use of private. Private, like landowners, as well as the aviation folks. We all know that we have very qualified and able people who work out in the woods, and one of the issues last year was that was not dealt with very well. And then I want to close on this document. I understand the concerns in terms of the confident level based on these words. What that caused me to do is I'm going to go back and I'll work with these two individuals and basically reiterate again. And as Charlie talked about, we just got to show some major differences and significant differences as we go into this fire season.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Just as a follow-up, I think any of us who have either worked around a forest fire or packed a house as a forest fire is coming towards us understand with acuity how serious this is. This transcends any party issues. We ought to work as collaboratively as we can with our federal folks. I know that Congressman Walden has been out on the forefront of this, and I think we as members of this body ought to do whatever we can to advance your ability to cut through some of these barriers, plus get us paid timely. And we ought to do whatever we can, politics notwithstanding. This threatens our entire state, and as we know from the snowpack this year and the potential of fuel on the ground, I think we look forward to another ominous season, and you, I think, should feel free to try to call on us to help you.
Thank you. I want to refer to a handout that will be coming around to you, and actually it refers to a question, Representative Johnson, you asked about our role in working with the private aviation folks, and the handout will actually describe a fire aviation work groups that we have, and I think the key piece here is the aviation advisory committee we have was made up of three individuals from, if you will, the aviation private sector, Dave Johnson, Bob Ferreira, and Don Hunt. And attached to that description of the aviation advisory committee is the activities that were accomplished or are still working on as initiated as of 2002. And I just want to bring that and show you how we're using the private sector folks in the aviation industry. And in fact, they have helped us tremendously in working on issues such as we just talked about and involving the federal agencies, as well as, if you will, getting our own aviation program the best that it can be. Charlie, anything to add to that?
Nope.
Okay.
And all these negotiations, Roy, is the governor's office leading the charge or at least signing letters supporting the work that you're doing? Well, and my point is that when we're dealing with federal agencies, I think it's important to have the governor of the state standing squarely behind us.
Senator Meserly and representative committee, the governor's office is very aware of the issues that particularly when we took the governor and his chief of staff at Medford to look at the Timber Rock fire. And I'm sure that the governor's office, especially with the director of the National Resource Policy Advisor, would be willing and when we feel it's appropriate to have them come and step in and help us with they will.
But generally we have not been doing that so far. No. It's been pretty much agency to agency has been our history for many years.
I just wonder if I wouldn't make it move easier for you with that kind of support and from our congressman.
Yes, Chair Meserly and member of the subcommittee, we agree. Yeah.
And I think we've already mentioned it, that if we need letters from this committee, let us know, too.
Thank you. I want to in terms of wrapping up the protection from fire program, and there was also a request for copies of the maps, the fire maps, and I think they're, are they out? Okay. And also the biscuit fire analysis, I think that you should have that too. Okay. And then lastly, actually two more things, referring to a conversation we had yesterday about what we are doing to help, if you will, the militia that is reducing because of retirements, etc. I forgot to also mention that we send our firefighters and people in other programs, like our state forest program, to out-of-state assignments, help other states with their fires. In doing so, they get qualified, they get their, if you will, their card checked off. But I think it's just another opportunity that we have, and we'll continue to do that. However, we don't do that at the expense of what we need to do at home, both in their regular job, and in particular, we are looking at a fire situation that we need to keep them. So it's just an opportunity we have taken, actually, in the last 3 years, a tremendous advantage of that opportunity to have people go out and help other states. But again, still making sure that our needs and our business is taken care of.
Right, when you say militia, you're talking more than the National Guard, I take it.
Yeah.
Could you define, I was going to ask this question yesterday, just exactly who are you talking about?
Oh, what, it's a term that we use. Again, last fire season, we had over 70% of our employees, all programs, in all locations, help in our fire effort last fire season. These are predominantly not people that are paid for or trained specifically for the fire program. So they could be FPFs, people in state forests, the Elliott, or in the Clatsop state forest, or folks who work in our Salem headquarters. When we have a fire situation that we need to mobilize beyond the local capacity, then these people then go and become our militia and help in these fire situations.
What we passed a couple of sessions ago, a bill that allowed the people that fight fire to be rated as a fire and policeman. Excuse me. So when we send out the militia folks, what does that do to our purge cost in the department? Does that rate those folks at least on a temporary basis the same as police and fire?
What we've done in that, and I'll ask Charlie to help also, is that we've identified, if you will, the different positions that all our employees are, if you will, that are assigned to them, and then they are qualified, and then, if you will, when you look at our mobilization plan, there is different fire assignment positions. And as I mentioned, all of our employees in the department, not just the folks dedicated in the fire department, in our fire department, are at any time when a situation arises, they are then mobilized to perform, if you will, as part of our militia. In the regard to the PERS, police and fire, we've looked at those position functions, not what they do in their normal job, but what would they do if we said, hey, you go to Medford and you're part of this incident management team and you're playing this role in an incident management team. We looked at those positions and we either identified them, I think predominantly either they're 12-month positions. They're usually people that are in the fire program are 12-month eligible, police and fire. Or if they're a forest practices forester and their normal job is not fire, but they are part of the militia, then those people get, if you will, 5 months credit under police and fire.
And that's part of the militia. It's specific positions. If they're trained to a higher level, where they're critical to the management of the fires, the division supervisors, the logistics chiefs, the the finance officers, those types of folks who have taken on additional training and additional responsibilities in those areas. We have a list of the positions. Those are the folks that get the 5 month credit. The folks that are unit foresters and assistant unit foresters in the protection program, fire is their job year round, whether it's planning or developing equipment or training in the off season or fighting fire in the regular season. They're firefighters year round under the system. Now, your part of your question was cost, and I'm going to have to look to Clark and see if he can help us with how much of a difference that makes in the system.
Again, Chair Messerly, Clark Seeley, we can bring you numbers in terms of the analysis from the 99 legislation, but my recollection of the actuarial study was in the order of a 0.007% impact over the span of the PERS estimated payout, 30, 35, 40 years, on the system by bringing our employees into the police and fire. And again, be glad to bring more detail to you.
I think it would be interesting, because maybe I'm confused here, but I thought that when we passed that bill in 99, maybe Senator Duke, you can help me. There was a long discussion about that, who would qualify and when would they qualify. And it was my recollection that they only qualified for the time they actually spent fighting the fires. And now I'm hearing you say that they're paid on a year-round basis, which sounds different, but maybe my memory is failing me.
I think the key is that our employees who are in the system for 12 months are employees who are in the fire program. They are the firefighters who are employed on a permanent basis. Those employees in the agency who do qualify for fire positions but are only used on an intermittent basis during the height of the fire season, for example, as Charlie described it, they're on a part-time basis in the system. So they are not considered police and fire under PERS on a full-time basis.
And that 5 months is based on the average length of seasons over the court, over the last several years. I don't believe, and I wasn't there during the deliberations, but I don't believe the discussion in 99 was that it would be just the time fighting fires, but the time that they're available and expected to respond. During those 5 months, those folks that are on the fire teams are on call for every third week, and they have to restrict their movements and that type of thing. I believe it was always anticipated that the full-time firefighters would be credited full-time, and it was left up to the state forester to determine who qualified in addition to that under the bill and how much credit they would be given. And after a lot of internal deliberations and whatnot, we'd settled on this 5 and 12 and reported that back to PERS.
I would, committee, I would be interested in what the initial cost of that action in 99 and how much that's expanded up through this budget.
Chair Miserly and member of the subcommittee, we can also bring our list of the folks that are qualified. So I think the point I want to make is not every fire-related position was determined to be police and fire eligible. And so we'll bring the list of those type of fire positions. The last thing that I have is really on, I believe it is B70. On page B70 is the state by state comparison.
Again, that would be B7?
B7.
B7?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, moving on to forest practices. There was a request yesterday about the status of the Pacific Rivers Council lawsuit against the state forester, and Charlie can provide a status of that for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, very quickly, the lawsuit was filed last February. Pacific Rivers Council, Coast Range Association, Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Association, Audubon Society of Portland, and the Native Fish Society sued the state forester in his official capacity. Initially, it was Jim. Now Roy is on the caption of the lawsuit. And the suit alleges that the state forester, by routinely approving written plans for forest operations that either conduct harvests in areas that are designated as high landslide hazard locations and or operations along small and medium fish-bearing streams and operations along non-fish-bearing streams that are directly tributary to coho salmon streams. By approving those written plans, the state forester is liable for taking salmon as a result of the theory, I guess, that that somehow those operations will ultimately and certainly result in damages downstream that will take fish, even though they have not been able to present any evidence to that effect. The state filed a motion to I would also point out that there are two things that they're asking for in the suit. One is declaratory relief, which they're not entitled to under the federal law, saying that the state forester is violating the Endangered Species Act, and then injunctive relief that would prohibit the state forester from approving such written plans on into the future. The state filed a motion to dismiss the suit under several theories of defense. Ultimately, the oral arguments for that were heard last October. The judge ruled in December, denied our motion to dismiss, basically saying that given the rules of lawsuits where you have to assume that the facts alleged by the plaintiff are the facts in the case, and then you look at the legal determinations as to whether there's no way, even with those with the assumption of those facts, that the plaintiff could prevail. If that's the case, then you dismiss the suit. The judge felt that there at least could be, under that fact situation, a connection that because the state forester approves plans, that created some liability for the eventual actions if fish were killed, that the state forester could be liable. So from that standpoint, she denied the motion to dismiss and then went ahead to consider the plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction, which would immediately, if issued, enjoin the state forester from approving plans on that first case of the three that they put in their suit. They only asked for a preliminary injunction in the case of the high hazard landslide locations. After the judge denied the motion to dismiss, the Board of Forestry in January adopted a temporary rule changing the rule structure and the way that we deal with the written plans so that the state forester no longer is put in the position of having to approve written plans. The operator still can submit those plans, and the state forester review them and advise the operator as to whether that plan will or won't result in compliance with the law. But ultimately, it's the conduct on the ground that will determine if they violate the requirements of the rules that are still the same. Then we take enforcement action against the individual, but it's not placing the state forester in the role of saying yes or no, you may conduct that operation. That took away a big chunk of the situations that might come under this preliminary injunction. There's still the possibility that a site that requires a written plan because it's alongside a fish-bearing stream could also be a high-hazard landslide location. We'd still have to approve those plans because the statute requires us to do so, as opposed to administrative rule. But it's a much narrower situation that might occur. The judge had 2 days of oral arguments in either late January or early February on the motion for preliminary injunction, and throughout that process, she kept asking the plaintiffs, can you show me a dead fish that tracks back to an operation that was conducted in a high landslide area that the state forester approved? And they weren't able to do that. And so she asked further, well, is it your theory then that I can, under federal law, require the state forester to hold off on approval of these operations for a 60-day or longer period in which you could then sue individual landowners under the ESA rather than the state forester to take enforcement against a specific case where you can show some connection. And they apparently indicated that, they thought that was possible. And so the judge took it under advisement, clearly skeptical of the arguments of the plaintiffs, but saying in her final discussion in the courtroom that if I think I have authority to issue an injunction in this case, I'm going to come back and hear further arguments from the state on some of the other things that we didn't concentrate on in the discussion. So either we're going to win at the preliminary injunction stage, or at least not get a preliminary injunction, or we're going to get a second crack at arguing why, or in what form that injunction ought to take place or not. So that's where it stands right now. It's under advisement. The judge has not ruled yet since those oral arguments in early February, and based on her discussion at that point, we felt that it probably would be 3 or 4 months before we hear from her, which also is a sign that she doesn't feel there's any real urgency for a preliminary injunction in this case. It's not like fish are dying by the droves, and she feels that somehow the state forester is responsible for that. Ultimately, if there's no preliminary injunction, there's still the potential for trial on the matter. But also, the judge asked the plaintiffs, what are we going to do at trial if I rule that there's no basis for a preliminary injunction here? Are you going to be able to bring anything forward that you haven't already tried that's going to convince me that you've got a case? So clearly, there's some skepticism on the part of the judge. Although she's doing a very thorough job, in our estimation, of looking at the authorities, playing it up straight for everybody concerned, certainly no complaints there. And we expect to hear from her in the next couple months.
I don't want to take a lot of time doing this, but I know by discussing with Jim Brown, there's another piece of this concern that if they are successful in their claim, then all land use decisions, all DEQ decisions, everyone is going to be held to the same test, or could be held to the same test. And could potentially turn our system of regulation. I wonder even if some of the federal agencies couldn't be held to the same test as well, which would mean that either the state agency is going to be held responsible, or the private sector is going to be put in such a very difficult position. At least in the state of Oregon, they're not going to be able to withstand that. Was there any discussions in the hallways or any place?
Yes, certainly. Well, there were certainly discussions with the governor's office, with the attorney general, with the other agencies. Just as you've portrayed it, there's considerable concern that if the case went against the state forester in this situation, that it would very much carry over to other agencies that issue permits, water resources for water withdrawals on streams that carry salmon would be far more liable, it would seem, than the forestry department might be in those circumstances. And so there is considerable concern. Certainly, if we lose at this stage of the game, we fully expect that the Attorney General's office would pursue appeals and run this on up through the system, because it has a very chilling effect on the state's ability to regulate and do its business. We don't believe, nor does the AG, that the Endangered Species Act was ever meant to be used in this fashion, and we'll continue to fight the case as far as it can be taken.
I assume you're being billed from the AG's office.
Of course.
And they're taking that out of your budget. And is there any discussion of, because of the magnitude of this lawsuit, some of the other agencies helping pay for it?
There is, in fact, and there are, I believe, either 6 or 7 other agencies that are helping to foot the bill in the defense of this case. Well, we also have interveners in the case in terms of the Oregon Forest Industries Council, the American Forest and Paper Association, Tillamook County, Small Woodlands Association, and an individual, John Christie from Astoria, who each have their own attorneys and are participating in the defense and paying all of their own costs in the process. And so a lot of additional legal help that's being paid for from the private sector.
Could we have a list of all of those who were signed on the lawsuit?
Certainly.
Sure, there's several environmental groups, and do they have a list of their memberships or who exactly signs on, or how does that work?
In the initial filing of the suit, I believe each of the organizations describes their organization and its membership and how it has standing in this situation. So we'll go back and pull out the court documents and provide that portion of the original suit to you, as well as the intervener's name.
That'd be really interesting, I think.
Mr. Chair, what kind of standing do you have to have?
I think that they had to petition the court to demonstrate their standing, and it basically is that if the injunction is issued, if they're enjoined, or if the state force is enjoined from approving these plans, these parties will be damaged in some fashion. Now, I'm talking about the interveners. Are you talking about the plaintiffs?
I'm talking
about
the plaintiffs, yeah. What kind of standing do they have to bring the case?
Don't have an answer for that. I think we'd probably have to get the attorneys to tell us more specifically, but I think under the Endangered Species Act, it's pretty liberal in terms of the citizen suit provisions that allow anyone who is concerned about the act not being appropriately applied probably has standing in some fashion.
If you were an organization, would you need to demonstrate, for example, that you have members in Oregon?
I know what you're thinking about, in terms of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. They do have a couple member organizations, I believe,
sure
in Oregon.
Sure, let's know who they are, because we've never been able to find them.
they aren't a large part of the Oregon fishing industry,
no,
to be sure.
I
don't believe that their write-up in the suit specifies those individuals, but we'll take another look at that.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Mesley and member of the subcommittee, if you believe Bill Lunch of OPBS, he also said that this case will have national interests in terms of the implications. So with that, I'm going to ask Charlie to help me with the performance measures of D2 and D3 on the tab, Forest Practices.
Well,
Charlie's finding it. I think that the first D2 chart actually shows us doing very well and getting reforestation back after harvesting.
Does anyone else have a telephone? Okay, go ahead. We've switched over to forest practices. The three performance measures. The first is an effectiveness measure. The other two efficiency measures in terms of delivery of the program. And that first one deals with compliance with reforestation standards. The original basis of the Forest Practices Act back in 1971 was a concern about whether or not landowners were reforesting.
Hold on, Mr. Charlie.
I feel better.
We're all lost. Here.
Forest practices.
It will be behind the tab that says forest practices.
You're on
the
page.
Okay.
D2.
D2 and D3.
Okay.
Anyway, the first chart there is compliance with reforestation standards. Anytime that a harvest takes place and stocking is reduced below a certain level, reforestation is required within 2 years following the harvest. And this shows that our compliance checks on all land ownership fall mostly above our line of 96%. On the initial, and that's on the initial check. If we have to take enforcement action, we go back and ultimately get those acres that are in violation back into compliance as well. These last several years, after a short dip in 1993 and after some changes in rules and whatnot, it's generally been up in the 98-99% initial compliance area. And that's been true as well clear back into the late 70s. So. Very successful in terms of landowners voluntarily, if you will, and it's a requirement, but on initial harvest, getting right in there, reforesting, and getting the land back into production. So that's the one effectiveness measure that's pointed to. There, of course, in forest practices, there are all kinds of other resources that we try to protect in terms of water quality and habitat and that type of thing. But they're not all that easily measured in many cases, and so we haven't prescribed this, and we are working on trying to develop additional performance measures. The other two...
Sure, let me ask you, if with that kind of compliance, we must have an awful lot more timber standing in the state than we did, because some of the stands are much better density than they were in the past, I'm sure. Could you give us some kind of indication what kind of gains we've made over the years?
I don't have hard numbers in terms of acres or stocking out there, but I think that clearly we're growing much more timber than we're cutting in the state. The work that our folks have done in terms of developing the first approximation report and that type of thing in terms of the condition of the forest clearly points out that we're growing a great deal more. The industry lands, the industrially owned lands, have been on a sustainable basis for probably the last 25, 30 years, where they're pretty much cutting what they're growing. But that's a relatively small percentage of the forest land overall. The federal land, with the lack of harvesting activity, I think I've heard the figure, it's growing 12 times as much as we're cutting at this point, and a vast amount of acreage out there. And the non-industrial private landowners tend to their cut goes up and down depending on the markets, but they have, other than a few real peak production times, have always been well below, their harvest has been well below what's growing out there. So building inventory in both the federal and the non-industrial sector and harvesting at a sustainable level in the industrial sector.
Thank you. Representative Krieger?
Chair Medley. Charlie, you and I had some discussions regarding this issue, and I was on the Board of Forestry because I didn't necessarily agree with the charts and the figures. There's a difference between the industrial landowner and the private, and there's a great difference if you look at acres compared to individuals. And I'd like you to address that, and also the fact that some of the things that we get criticized for in forestry are the things that are visible. And the private ownerships, for the most part, are adjacent to other owners' properties, county roads, state roads, those type of things. And also address that I find that the free-to-grow issue is someplace where the forest practice people are fighting, and I'm working with the one we have in Gold Beach on about 20 that I just happen to know about. I mean, that's one part of one county, 20 that I know of. Still aren't resolved. So could you address the fact that acreage on a chart compared to if you were to take out the private from the industrial chart might be up near 100%, but I don't think you'd find that based on individuals, not acreages.
And that's all certainly true. This chart is based on acres in compliance, and so the vast majority of acres that are harvested are being reforested immediately. There are individuals who generally with smaller acreages that do have violations. In fact, the citations that are issued in any given year for the Forest Practices Act, the most frequent are for failure to notify the state forester of intent and also for failure to have written plans. After that, reforestation is the next violation, but we're talking about numbers in terms of 25 or 30 cases a year. They are highly visible, and we don't always catch them initially. Wayne is, Representative Krieger. I'm sorry to be familiar, but I've known him for nearly 30 years and worked with him when I was the Forest Practices Forester at Gold Beach. But has kept a close eye on this in his area and does find some situations. I think what we can report, again, not trying to paint an overly rosy picture, but once we know about situations that are in violation, we try to stay with them and make sure that one way or another they get reforested. Either the landowner that is in control of it ultimately sees the light, or we make it difficult enough that they sell the property to someone else who will take care of it. And we've got a pretty good history of those types of situations, but Representative Krieger is absolutely right. The situations tend to be more visible in, because the cases that we have in violation are typically non-industrial owners who are not in the business of intensively managing their property. They've either inherited it or they're holding it for a one-time harvest, and then once they've done that, they've got the money out of it. They're not interested in what the future is going to bring, and we do have enforcement cases with those types of situations.
Okay. Yes, follow.
Farley, could you go ahead and address that free-to-grow issue, because I'm finding that they can come back in on that coastal area and actually be in compliance. And you look at that stand at the 8th, 9th, or 10th year, and it is not free-to-grow, nor will it ever be.
The requirement in the Forest Practices Rules is that the reforestation be achieved after 2 years, and then 4 years later, that the trees are in a condition where they're out competing the surrounding vegetation and what we call free to grow. At that point, if the required species, predominantly conifers, are healthy and clear of competition, they're going to break through and do all right. In the coast in particular, and actually in the Cascades as well, that sometimes is a more difficult proposition where you get significant competition from other vegetation. And while the requirement is that we check them at planting and free to grow, the budget that we've had and the priorities in the program, we haven't been doing as thorough a job of checking free to grow as we're checking planting compliance. In most cases, if they're planted, they do make it through. In some of the areas where there's more competition and or, again, the landowner who doesn't take care to do vegetation control, to go the extra effort to make sure those trees are brought on, they can be out-competed and choked off to the point where they don't become a stand. If we catch them within that first 4 years after planting that they're not making it free to grow, we can take action. If they are, if they appear to be making it at that stage and they go longer and then fail, which I would think would be rare, we don't really have a mechanism at that point on down the road to do anything further with the landowner. But I hope that's not as much of a case. It isn't something that we've tracked that closely since the change in the law, and as we've had to make other priorities. By and large, if you're looking at the investment it would take to do that versus the amount of area that is reforested and up and growing, we're not losing acres to overall to change in use and that type of thing. The economy, based on growing trees and harvesting, is in good shape from that standpoint. There's a lot of other regulatory threats and other threats, but from the standpoint of growing the trees, I don't think we have that big a concern.
Okay. Roy, let me just say, I want to run this hearing till 10:10, and then I want to leave some time for Mr. Starker to testify. So if you can see a clock, that's 15 minutes away. So.
Okay. I want to refer to page D10, just like in the Protection from Fire program, just briefly describe the Forest Practices Act program design. And again, moving off the statutes into the Board of Forestry as the board and the department develop rules, that we have on the sides regional committees, on the left-hand side, regional committees that help the board in looking at forest practices rules, as well as on our right-hand side, technical committees, other state agencies, and research communities and colleges in helping that process. And as you go down the chart, I think it very clearly, and I'll try not to be redundant here, but as we look at the bottom in terms of those bottom two roles of, if you will, how we deliver the program, as we move and look ahead into the new biennium, 03-05, essentially our priorities will be less in enforcement, compliance inspection, and interagency cooperation. So if you would, you would actually put your hand on the right-hand side of those four blocks, and they would be de-emphasized and would be more in education technology transfer information management. And we want to keep the monitoring and the, and if you will, the engineering and the administration as we look in terms of how we want to deliver this program as we look in the forward, into the next biennium. Charlie, anything to add to that?
No? Okay. I want to clarify, when I look at the different state agencies or resource agencies and whatever, do any of those agencies or any other segments of Oregon, the state of Oregon, have Trump over your activities in the Department of Forestry? Thinking of DEQ or Water Resources or Division of State Lands or any of them?
Yes, Mr. Chair, in the case specifically of water quality, in 1991, there was a very careful compromise worked out here at the legislature that established both for the Environmental Quality Commission and the Board of Forestry a process to ensure that if the EQC, for instance, felt that the forest practice rules were not achieving water quality standards, and they have the ability to petition the board to examine their rules anyone can petition the board to do that. But if the EQC feels that, that they're not being satisfied, they can keep the board working on it until they come up with a set of rules that they feel will satisfy the water quality standards. That's, I believe, the only particular situation. And, excuse me, similarly, the quid pro quo, if you will, is that the Board of Forestry can petition the EQC to examine its water quality standards and whether they're appropriately determined from a scientific basis and that type of thing, and how they affect the forest environment. So there's a kind of a balancing element there, but ultimately, if the EQC doesn't feel the forest practice rules are achieving water quality standards, they can require the board to keep working at developing rules that will do that. Other than that, the Act is quite explicit that the Board of Forestry is the exclusive authority for the adoption of rules and enforcement in terms of forest practices in Oregon.
Charlie, is this Acrotat consultation from the Environmental Quality Commission? That's different than what you just expressed.
Right. Under the rulemaking authority portion of the Forest Practices Act, it requires that the Board of Forestry consult with, and there's a full list of agencies and programs, the Scenic Waterways Program of the Division of State Lands, the Fish and Wildlife Endangered Species Programs of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, et cetera, all of those various programs that deal with impacts from forest practices. The board is required to consult with them when they're making rules and give those agencies the opportunity to comment during the rulemaking process. But the board still has the final say in terms of what rules they adopt and don't adopt. So that's the consultation piece. The part that I was talking about earlier is adopted separately and at a later time back in 527-775, I believe it was.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Dukes?
When you were developing rules for the Forest Practices Act, did any state agency have any lingering concerns that weren't resolved?
Well, we've been continuously adopting rules for about 30 years, refining them over time. I think there have been times when an agency's concerns weren't entirely satisfied, but generally speaking, the board has worked through those issues and tried to bring it to a point where the other agencies, if they had concerns, ultimately have been able to come in and say, yeah, we agree with that, we accept that. Certainly in 1994, the last major set of changes in terms of water quality and fish habitat prior to the efforts that we're just engaging in now were adopted after the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Environmental Quality came in and said, yeah, we agree with these. And that's generally the case.
Do you believe that this legislative direction has been met, that you're managing consistent with the sound management of soil, air, water, fish, and wildlife resources and scenic resources that assures the continuous benefits of those resources for future generations of Oregonians?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I'm somewhat biased, but I certainly do believe that that has been the case. I guess I would point out, I'm not sure if the emphasis was intended or not, but the scenic resources portion there is a very limited circumstance. It's spelled out further in the law that deals with highway corridors that that require trees be left along those certain designated highways. So it doesn't speak to the beauty or lack thereof of a clear-cut harvest, which is in the eye of the beholder.
Its own scenic resource, yes.
But yes, I think the Act has been quite successful in providing for sound management, and obviously there are detractors who don't agree with that. That's, you know, you see the PRC lawsuit and other other evidence of that. But when I think back to conditions when I was a forest practices forester 25 years ago, and the Act was only 5 years old, versus where we are today, tremendous progress.
Well, we've changed it, adjusted as we go along, but we're unheaded here. Mr. Chair, I'm still struggling between Forest Practices Act for private lands and the Forest Management Plan for public state-owned timberlands. And we went out and I had some of it explained to me last week, but I'm still struggling. I mean, if the idea is that we have a higher level to maintain at the state on the state lands, this sounds like a pretty high level to me. Can somebody tell me that we're managing to a lower level on the private lands than we are? I mean, it sounds to me like we're managing to a higher level than the state lands. Why?
I think the important thing to recognize about the Forest Practices Act, and folks tend to think of it as purely a environmental protection type of act, and in fact, the Forest Practices Act is designed to maintain the economic and social benefits of growing and harvesting in Oregon, and so it anticipates a private land model of what's appropriate that still provides for sound management of soil, air, water, fish and wildlife, but allows the landowner to harvest their trees and grow another crop and keep that cycle going. And so I think that's the crux of the difference, that the land management objectives of the public land and the land management objectives of the private land are different objectives, and yet they're both being managed soundly in terms of it's still clean water coming off of those lands, either case, good fish habitat, elements of wildlife habitat that need more specific protection as opposed to across the landscape generally. And that's where it allows for differences in management.
If we're meeting all of those things, then what's the difference that we need to manage for?
Chair Merrily and member of the subcommittee, I will try to describe why the broader, if you will, the economic, social, environmental services on public land, or if you will, state managed land. And as you look in the Board of Forestry, as I understand the statutes, it refers to greatest permanent value, meaning that, as a matter of fact, the Board of Forestry, when they had this conversation and discussed it, it was interpreted that there was a broader array, and its purpose was not just solely the growing and harvesting of trees, although that's an important and recognizes an important activity to do because of the special relationship we have with the counties on Board of Forestry lands. Matter of fact, some would say that that's not the appropriate priority that the department's putting on as we define the greatest permanent value. And our points are is that it is a array of those social, economic, and environmental goods and services over the landscape over time, which recognizes that, you know, we do harvest on those lands, and but because, if you will, the other values of these public lands over a long history with the board and others in that conversation is why that the, if you will, the Board of Forestry Land has or appears to be that we are doing more than above the Forest Practices Act. And that was clearly a conscious conversation with the Board of Forestry
when we looked at the greatest permanent value, and then as we developed the plan, and then the implementation of those differences. Have tremendous public input in that process in terms of different viewpoints about that. And we're prepared to talk about that a lot more tomorrow, as well as the common school land difference and what happened there and that conversation.
I would like to think we can wait till tomorrow, but I want
to
get into
stuff. I
would
like to do that if we could.
Like, I mean, if the statute says that you have to manage for sound management of all of these things, is there a level above sound management? Because clearly we have two different levels of management.
I think Senator, that
I hadn't read the statute in a whole lot of years since we read it the last time. It just raised a whole bunch of questions.
I really do want to get into that when we talk about state lands, and I have a question from Representative Krieger, and then I want to allow time for Mr. Starker to speak.
Senator, most of what I want to talk about is what Senator Dukes is going, and I'd rather do that tomorrow when we get into it. It'd be better.
Right, you got a minute or two to wind up here for the day.
Chair Mearsley and members of the subcommittee, this is actually a good point to pause.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
A lot of information. And will you need to carry on with the Board of Practices Act tomorrow then, as part of the agenda? Or?
Just, I would say, probably about 10, 15 minutes and we can wrap that up.
All right.
Thank you, Chair.
Good. Thank you. Mr. Starker? Would you like to come testify?
Chairman Meserly, I don't know if this guy has any credentials.
Careful, Representative. Some of these folks might have some stories on you, too.
Got several.
Good. I'll give you extra time. Go ahead, sir.
Chair Meserly, members of the committee, I'm Bart Starker. We're a fourth generation company, and I'm executive vice president of a fourth generation company in Corvallis, Oregon, called Starker Forests. And got a couple other little jobs on the side, chair of the emergency fire cost committee, and I'm here today to. Just to reinforce, I think, what you're already thinking, that fire program is pretty important to the state. One of the first things I remember my grandfather telling me when I was growing up was that you don't start practicing forestry until you have your snags down. And that was one of the ways he imparted to me how important fire protection was to a forestry investment. And so it's been part of my life. Ever since that time, the fire protection is the initial building block to a forestry investment. And if you can't reasonably assured that your forest land is going to be fire free, you can't justify the investment in it. And so it's the initial building block of a forestry investment. And also one of the other pieces of that puzzle is that the crop is not insurable. So if you lose it through a fire, it's just gone, and you have to start over. Oregon has a system that's unlike any other in the West. Most other Western states that I'm aware of have our fire programs are completely general funded, and landowners are really not direct part of it. In Oregon, we have a cooperative system, and landowners are involved at every step of the way. And I think that makes us a lot different, and also keeps the motivations and the risks and the costs aligned, so that everybody feels like they're a piece of it, and they have a stake in how it goes and how efficient it happens. Motivates people to be involved. You've probably already heard from the staff today about the three levels of kind of the how the bills are paid when these fires occur. So I'll go through it just really quickly. The first level is the district level, and that is there are 13 districts around the state, and the funding there is 50-50, the general fund paying 50%, landowners paying 50%, that was a long, sought-after compromise that basically came about because basically 50% of the fire costs were public-caused fires. And that's has been traditional for quite some time, and I think has worked well. The next level is we have the committee that I'm a chair of is the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, and that committee currently has a deductible that's $10 million. That's landowner money completely. It's a series of different kinds of assessments, and I won't go into the details of that today, but it's no general fund money in that deductible. That $10 million, it's annual deductible. And so that's over and above the district level of protection that's 50% general fund and 50% landowner money. And then each district also has district deductibles they have to meet before they can be eligible for that $10 million emergency fire fund. And over and above the deductible that the fund has is an insurance policy that, as you may have probably very familiar with, and we're still in negotiations about whether we're going to be able to secure that this year and what the terms of that insurance policy will be. We're hopeful, though, and we've got some initial thoughts that will be available this year. We just don't know the details of what the actual price and terms will be yet. At least we haven't seen it in writing yet. So we'll let you know as soon as we know. there's several reasons why the insurance costs are skyrocketing. Of course, 911 did the insurance market no favors, and then we've had in Oregon two claim years in a row, and insurance companies don't really like claims that well. They tend to jack your rates up when you get claims. So. And then the third piece that's probably a fairly huge piece of this puzzle is the federal fire policy that's, or lack thereof, and the lack of management that's going on our federal lands that has caused a huge increase in the fire problem on our private lands. And that affects our ability to get this insurance. And we need to be cognizant of that and try to do whatever we can to encourage our federal partners to proactively manage both their forests and their fire problem. I guess the thing that I see that we can do the most directly about to ensure that we have this insurance policy is we need to fund our basic level of protection in the state at the local level. Keeping the fire small is the best thing we can do in order to keep that insurance policy in place. And so I just urge you to do whatever you can. I know you have everybody that comes in here wants a piece of the general fund, and I realize the conundrum you're dealing with, and I'm appreciative of that. But this is a pretty important piece of the state's economy and investments that are occurring out there. Another piece of the dilemma is that, and I heard the staff talking about this, was that every other Department of Forestry program during a bad fire year is part of the fire program. And so when you cut one piece of the department, you're cutting fire program one way or the other in a bad year. And that's but I also think that the department agrees that our fire funding is the most important piece of the Department of Forestry budget, and we would protect it over others. So that's it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Questions, Mr. Parker? I just want to tell you that in our conversations with the co-chairs and the leadership here in the legislature, I think there is a consensus that the fire protection is a very high priority. If we're going to protect school funding and other things into the future, we simply have to protect our forests. So I'm hopeful, but it is a tight budget this year, and we're trying to find all the efficiencies we can. But thank you. Yeah, Representative Krieger.
Chair. See you, Mark.
See you.
We had the biscuit fire down there. If it hadn't been
for a change in weather and the wind, that thing would have went to the ocean.
You were in the way.
Yeah, I was in the way. My tree farm. And that's where I think we have to relate the fact that it is the public, it's all of Oregon, who needs to help step up from the general fund for the prior program. It isn't just forest land. And when you really get down to who really does that around those homes and the rural setting and the rural interface, it is the forest program, infrastructure that's within the department and even the federal that is has the expertise and to guide that to make sure that we don't lose residences and right into our cities, because in Brookings could have gone, they said in 2 days, 2.5 days, it could have been burned right to the coast. And people don't realize how bad that was down there, but boy, I'm telling you, it was unbelievable. And I testified before the board just recently. I said, hey, the fire program is my priority. I think our chair and everyone understands how important that is. We're going to do our best.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I will close the public hearing and adjourn the committee meeting.